Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
My name's Mick. I do hope you're well. Thank you so much for joining us for Mental Health Monday from Radio City Talk. And once again, an action-packed show. Loads of different conversations to have with a really great guest who's going to talk through a million and one different things, which will aid you through obviously the lockdown scenario, but hopefully some tips and some advice that how we move beyond coronavirus, lockdown and everything in between. Sam Walkden is our guest now. She's up and about on Instagram as Mentally Fit Sam. And I guess, Sam, that's the dream, isn't it? Throughout all of this, to be mentally fit. If we talk about physical fitness, we can talk about mental fitness as well.
Absolutely.
And, absolutely crucial, isn't it, that we get that balance right and we consider our mental fitness throughout all of this.
Absolutely. I think that's the thing. People often take it for granted that we should just focus on one of them. And if we have the good physical fitness, you know, we can always maintain our mental health and vice versa as well.
Yeah, I've spoken to many sports stars who say that they've always, one of the key struggles for them is that when they are physically fit, because they can run a 10K, you know, relatively straightforwardly, it's quite a frustrating thing for them to be at the peak of your physical fitness, but to have mental fitness challenges during that time as well. But we've got to make sure that we understand the needs of both of those things to make sure that we're living healthily, that we marry the two together and find our own way forward.
Yeah, and like you say, it's a great point with the athletes as well. A lot of people presume that when they use the word fitness, they are just referring to the physical. And it's far more beyond that. Obviously, the chemicals that are in our brain, I won't get too psychological, but all of that is involved in the process of our mindset. And it all comes together so we can achieve our best possible self. And that's the goal at the end of the day, to be our best self physically and mentally, to achieve whatever it is in our lives that we want to achieve.
Now, it's fair to say, Sam, you've got a great deal of experience within the mental health field. You're doing PhD research at the moment, is that right?
That's correct. I'm in my third year at the moment.
So just tell us about the investigation that you've got ongoing at the moment, because it's a really interesting sort of angle you've gone down.
So my PhD thesis is focused on investigating public perceptions of mental illness, but specifically mental illness in an offending population. So how it is that the public perceive individuals that I work with at a forensic psychiatric unit who have mental health problems and have committed offences, the majority of them. And I'm a firm believer, as I'm sure you are, that everyone deserves a second chance. And if somebody isn't mentally well at the time of their offence, we should work with them and make sure that they have the best support possible so that moving forward into the future, they can have the best life and not face the stigma that is out in society every day. So my research does focus on looking at how the public perceive these individuals and then eventually how we can work with the public to reduce that stigma and give them a reasonable and realistic perception of that risk, because it is very minimal, the risk of them reoffending once they have their mental health under control. So that's mainly what I'm doing in my research at the minute.
That's interesting. You mentioned the word stigma, which is, you know, the most repeated, you know, word we have on this program, really. But that's a great example of it. A lack of understanding that people have about why people do certain things because of potential mental health problems they have or mental illnesses. I think at the moment there is a natural reaction, probably due to the tabloid nature of how we get a lot of news, that if somebody's done a bad thing, it's because they chose to do a bad thing and therefore they should be punished in exactly the same way. It's clearly much more complicated than that. And so much of the work that we've talked about on this program over the years has been about highlighting where potential problems can emerge in society, and you can take proactive responses to prevent these situations emerging in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is still a heavy focus on punishment, and the focus should be shifted towards treatment, because if we continually punish someone and tell them that they're not worthy of being in this society and facing the stigma, like you've said, they're just going to respond in the same way. So you treat someone like that, they're going to say, well, I must not be worthy, so I'm just going to continue. I'm just going to repeat the same action I've done before. Whereas if we focus on the treatment and encouraging them to be part of society and contribute, they will actually respond in turn and contribute back to society. And without that stigma being in the way, there are so many more opportunities for everybody to work together.
And that's a really interesting, I'm sure it's going to be an absolutely fascinating piece of research. Look forward to reading some more on that as and when it's completed. You've worked in psychiatric services as well for more than 5 or 6 years now. Community support. So you see on a day-to-day basis the realities of mental illness, of mental health, and seeing different people on different paths. The variety is almost too huge, isn't it, to fully comprehend the journeys that people are on. And sometimes when we talk about mental health, some people go, well, it's all very well saying, talk to a friend, it's okay to not be okay. But there are also many people who've got specific needs and specific mental illnesses that can't be helped by having a conversation with a loved one or a neighbour. They require clinical assessments. And again, we need to be aware of all of these things, that this is a huge spectrum that we're dealing with within the mental health world.
Yeah, so if I can just clarify the difference between mental health and mental illness, I think that would be helpful for people. So mental health, as with physical health, is something that everybody has. So on a day-to-day basis, our mental health can fluctuate. Obviously, it can fluctuate weekly. It can fluctuate after the loss of a loved one. Lots of different events. And obviously, this current situation in the world is making people's mental health fluctuate more. Whereas mental illness is when that their mental health has then got quite severe and it's affecting the person daily, weekly. It's stopping them from completing tasks that they would, if I want to use the abbreviated terms, normally complete. I don't like to use the word normal, but it's difficult to not use it. So when I'm saying normal, I just mean your baseline, not normal as in abnormal, if that makes sense. So I think that people who are struggling with their mental health, it's really important that you talk about that with friends and family all the time. We should always be talking about that every day. Whereas mental illness, if you've been diagnosed with a condition, again, it's important to talk to your family and friends, but also get that team involved, getting your doctor involved, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, whatever it is that you need to have involved. Make sure that your family are involved in that process and they understand the different levels of support that you need to seek dependent on what your diagnosis is.
It's great to get that clarification out there. Sam Walkden is our guest. She's up and about on Instagram, at MentallyFitSam. Loads of different posts on that one. Kanashi, in terms of sort of your expertise on this one, as we've headed into these, quote, unprecedented times, are there things that you can draw on from a psychiatric point of view that, although the circumstance isn't maybe anything we've dealt with before, you can fit a particular template to it? So, for instance, people aren't sleeping very well at the moment. How many times have you had a conversation with people who are saying, you know, I'm really struggling, or I'll wake up in the middle of the night, or I'll wake up significant hours earlier than I would normally wake up? Are you, as a from a psychiatric point of view, able to tell people why that is the case without having to be an expert in COVID-19 and run a load of, you know, frameworks around coronavirus and how it affects people?
Yes, that's a really good question, actually. Obviously, I would be an expert when I've got my PhD in my specific area, but definitely expertise, yes. So routine is something that I've always been pushing, you know, since the years that I've been working in these services and since I did my master's degree. Routine is vitally important, and especially with parents having children at home at the minute as well, I know they're struggling even more because that routine has just shifted so much. So the importance of sleep, which I think people do kind of skate over, I can stay up all night and do these assignments. As a student, I can definitely relate as well. I was always in quite a good routine with myself because I was very strict. But I think the importance of sleep, and I don't know if I'm not going to go into all the technical terms, but melatonin, which is a sleep hormone, it's so vitally important that you keep that at the correct level throughout the day by having those periods where you come off your screen or you use blue lights. If a lot of people are on screens at the minute, having that yellow light in the background and the blue lights blurring, you need to reduce that to night mode to prepare yourself to sleep. So not being on Zoom calls until like 1 a.m. and then trying to get some sleep, it won't work. So a lot of different things you can do, and I'm quite happy to send anybody who wants it, myself and a colleague at Apollo Nutrition, who she's a nutritionist, we developed a short free guide which is how to support people who are struggling with sleep. And that's got a lot of info in. So anyone can message me on my Instagram and I'll send them that if they want some more information on why that's so important and how to develop a healthy sleep routine as well.
I guess as well, you know, that thing of, you know, if you have one bad night's sleep, you kind of feel the next day. But I know this as a parent that, you know, if you get like two bad night's sleep, then suddenly it becomes, and then if you have, and then you end up doing a thing where if you go to bed knowing you're not going to have a good night's sleep, it's quite a bad place to be, because you're thinking, not only do I feel bad now, but I know I'm not going to feel any better. And then I think that's when your mind starts to play games with yourself about what your pathway forward is.
So a psychologist friend of mine said this to me. She's a clinical psychologist, and she said, there's this thing called sleep debt. And people think that if they have that one night's sleep, I'll just catch up on it and I had 5 hours tonight, so I'll just have 9 hours tomorrow. It doesn't work like that. You need to have you know, they stay between 6 and 8 hours. It does depend on you. I'm not saying everyone needs to get a certain number. I can probably function on about 5 or 6, but it's about knowing yourself and what you need. But as you can see, my dog next to me doesn't need any help with that routine. He just constantly sleeps. But yeah, it's about getting yourself into the correct cycle that works for your life. And especially with my client who has a brain injury, shout out to her if she's listening, but she did really well getting herself into that routine because of her injury. She needed to be a lot more strict on what she needed. And obviously teenagers, if anyone's listening to this who has teenage children, it's vitally important that they remain in that school kind of routine where they are having the correct amounts of sleep and they're not staying up all night, because it will affect them in a few weeks' time.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Will there be some people now who are thinking, why am I not sleeping? But then we've got to bear in mind that our entire life routines have changed. Most people aren't leaving the house anymore. You know, just the general exercise that comes with running for a bus or being in an office environment has kind of changed, because we're now, you know, we're doing the working from home thing. People are setting up home offices. Then the schools aren't going out. We're not doing the school run in the same way. We don't even get the chance to pop out for a coffee or things like that during the day. So our whole routine during the day is impacted. Presumably that affects our ability to then lie in bed at the end of the day.
I think there are so many comments I could say on that one. I think I'll say two comments. The first one being, like I said before, the amount of people that are now doing Zoom meetings like we are now and having those lights on constantly, it does affect the melatonin in your brain. It does affect your sleep cycles and your circadian rhythms, which are related to your eyes and your brain. It does affect that. So a lot of parents are having those exhaustive feelings. But the second thing about that is making sure that you have a different environment for work and sleep. I'm a stickler for this as well, staying in bed and doing work in bed, not particularly in bed, but just sat on my bed with my laptop, because it's more comfortable than sitting in a chair all day. And having that distinction between this is sleep time and this is office time, because it won't help you if you stay in the same room all day. If you sat down and your body's in that same position, you do need to keep moving so that your body gets into that sleep routine all the way through the day, not just a few hours before bed.
Yeah, and in terms of sort of being honest with yourself during these times as well, we've kind of got to, you know, sometimes it's easier to just think, you know, I'll just get my head down and I'll just plow on through this scenario and hopefully it won't last forever. But we've got to be honest that it is completely different. And our lives in work are very, very different. And our lives outside of work are also completely different. This has been fundamentally a complete overhaul. Sort of overhaul of our way of life, and we've got to recognize that we're not going to feel the same as we used to feel. We're not just going to be, you know, cracking on as per normal. Of course not. Everything's different.
I think there's a lot of guilty feelings, is what I'm hearing from quite a few people that have reached out to me.
Screen
just stopped there for some reason. A lot of guilty feelings that people are saying, you know, oh, well, I saw such and such a body online. They were doing something with the children. I've not done that. I feel bad. And it's not about comparing yourself to somebody else you've seen online. It's about being honest about what your levels are. During lockdown, I've learned some sign language. I'm obviously still doing my PhD. I'm working my other jobs and I've written a book. But that's me. That's what I want to do. And that's my level. I would never tell anyone else that they should be also reaching that level. It's about making sure that you are honest with what your progress is and what your limits are. If your limit is that you get out of bed, you make yourself some breakfast, you go back and sit in your bed, good for you. That's your level. And that's what you need to do to make sure you maintain some sort of healthy routine. Just do what's best for you, but be honest about what your level of engagement is at this time and what is good for you mentally and physically.
I admire the fact you've been able to be so sort of, you've been able to manage that level of work, particularly working on a PhD, which is, you know, incredibly difficult at any time and in any circumstance as well. I'm finding, I don't know about you, Sam, the days for me are absolutely flying by. I know some people who are going, oh, they're watching the clock because, you know, the kids are being homeschooled, but they're also trying to work at home as well. And I'm kind of finding before breakfast is done, then it's almost lunchtime. This is when I'm at home and not in the office. And then my lad goes down for his little nap. But by the time that I try and get something done, that's the mistake I make, to try and get something done during that hour. Next, you know, he's got to be getting up. It's snack time. He's in the garden for a quick run around. Then suddenly it's tea time. And then before we know it, it's bath time. And it's like every single day sort of blends into one big thing. And then, you know, there'll be people, oh, I should have learned to play a musical instrument, or I'm meant to do X, Y, and Z. I'm thinking at the end of each day, I'm thinking, right, what happened then? What have we managed to achieve today?
Do you like to write yourself a list of things that you want to achieve, or do you kind of just play it by ear?
You know, I think because my wife is doing the homeschooling, she has the list of things to achieve that week through school. And then we have the other list, which is the jobs that kind of need doing around the house. But we tend to find that we end up squeezing them all into the weekend and then getting to the Sunday night and then going, oh, right, well, that was the weekend then. We go again for Monday morning. But then I feel like the time is moving really quickly at the moment. And again, that's not the experience of everybody who sometimes feel like the time's really dragging.
I think I'd suggest for everyone as well, it's really good that you do have a list of things that you want to do proactively, but also having a list of things that you want to do for yourself and for you and your partner. I know that can be super hard. I don't have any children, but it must be really difficult to fit time in for you two as well. But also having a list of things you want to do, like that I need to do for the house, but then also things I want to do, like I still want to spend some time watching a film with my partner, or maybe we can write a list of things we want to do after lockdown, which can be quite refreshing. Or things that we've already achieved together, just kind of trying to return to some level of normalcy, because in a few months' time, hopefully, it will get more normal. But we don't want to not prepare for that. So it'll be good to write a list of things that you want to do to kind of, in an attempt, I know the weather's quite bad today as well, attempt to make it more normal and get out a little bit more when and if we can with the government regulations. But yeah, having lists for me works really well. And I have a list of things that I can do in 10 minutes, things that I can do in a couple of hours, and things that I will need to do more long term. So I can pick one. I'm like, right, I've got half an hour, I'll pick one off here. So I know that it's going to be achievable, rather than trying to set myself a ridiculous target of finishing my PhD this week, which won't happen, obviously.
Absolutely. But you might get halfway through one particular chapter of it in the next 3 hours,
yeah,
and so
probably.
On and so forth. No, absolutely. notebooks. We all need notebooks through coronavirus and COVID-19. When you talk about mental health with children, it's a really interesting sort of thing to do, because I've started having these conversations, Sam, with my five-year-old daughter about feeling happy and feeling sad, feeling angry. And we try and have conversations when she's not in any of the extremes of those particular feelings, to talk through what those feelings are and what they look like and how it's okay to have certain feelings. And is it bad that I always come back to Inside Out, the Disney Pixar movie, about all the feelings in the little girl's head and how they essentially all have to work together to help the little girl out? And you can be happy and you can be sad, and that's okay throughout all of that.
No, I really like that film, actually. I think that's a good one. I've never heard anyone compare it to, you know, when talking about it, but you've made a good point there. I actually do like that film. I think it is useful to use things that normalize it to children. So that's a really good point that you've made. It's not about sitting them down and saying, we need to discuss this serious topic, because then it makes it sound like something scary and something that, you know, we can only talk about it when it's being serious. So I think that comparing it to films like that, and also what I'd say for young children around, you know, maybe 7 and below, would be to get them to draw the feelings rather than write them down, because, you know, some children struggle with the feelings, some adults struggle with the feelings. So it would be good to get them to draw a picture of how they're feeling, or a picture of the house, or other people around them, just so you can get a perspective on who they trust. And, you know, the colours that they use, that might be a good indication of how they're feeling at the moment. Try not to look into it too much if you're not, you know, an analyst in children's drawings, but it would be good. It's a good way to start the conversations, and also say, how do you think I'm feeling at the minute? And try and get them to take different perspectives, so they can say, well, how's daddy feeling? Have you seen mummy do such and such a thing? So then they can normalize your behaviors as well. And it'll just make them more understanding that that's a safe topic to talk about, and something that they can in future talk about with friends as they get older.
So if she drew a picture and like daddy was angry on the picture, is it okay to say, why do you think daddy is angry? Or is there something else going on?
I'd probably get her to label the feelings, because it might be that she just thought you had strange eyebrows. I mean, you know, kids can do things like that. But yeah, I mean, I'd always say to them, can you draw how you're feeling? And she might just draw a butterfly or something. Kids don't usually just draw themselves spontaneously. She might draw flowers, whatever it is, and then say, why have you drawn that? And always get them to explain it, but also take part in it as well. So if you're asking her to do something, you do it as well. So that's a little challenge for you as well. You draw yourself a little picture and then say, well, I've drawn it because of this. And she can say, oh, that's a good idea. And then it will open her to more ways of expressing herself, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Here's the crucial question then. Instead of being, post-lockdown, instead of like taking a load of crayons and blank piece of paper to my mates in the pub, How do you transfer that to speaking to people from, you know, a slightly older generation? What's your best advice on this one? Because it's something which I think, having done this program, I've found enough hints and tips to find my way around those conversations quite comfortably now, without it being awkward or sort of almost becoming like you're trying to invade someone's privacy. But when we tell people to talk about mental health, people want to make sure that they're not asking the wrong questions and talking about the wrong thing, or being invasive to someone who doesn't want to open up to them. They may want to open up, but it might not be to you or I. It might be someone a little bit close to them, maybe someone in a workplace environment, maybe somebody in a professional environment who's not linked emotionally to them.
I think the first thing to say is that there are no wrong questions when you're talking about mental health. So any conversation that opens a door to someone expressing how they feel can't be an incorrect question. So just ask a question. The second thing is to ask an open question rather than a closed question. So a lot of us are, you know, I'm still guilty of it myself. We'll just say, are you okay? And they'll go, yes. And you'll be like, I'm busy. You know, it's a busy world. We get on with our things. Sometimes I have to think, no, that wasn't, it wasn't not the wrong question. It just wasn't the correct question. Maybe I should have said, how are you feeling today? Or I remember when you said this, you know, do you still feel that way? But just making it open so that they have an opportunity to bounce that back to you, and making sure that you've opened that door for them. Even if it's just that you've seen something on their social media that they've posted that might have seemed a little bit out of character. And as well, there's a free suicide awareness course that I did with my client. And it just gets them to think about, to talking about challenging topics, but also remembering that there's no wrong way to approach them. So even with suicide, which is a very serious topic, saying to someone who you genuinely feel is thinking about suicide, are you thinking about suicide? That's not a wrong question, because you're not going to cause them any more harm. And if they are thinking about it, they've already got to the point where that's quite harmful for them. So starting a conversation on any topic to do with mental health is the correct thing to do.
Yeah, it was interesting actually doing the training that we did on air a couple of weeks ago. The reaction when people heard that, they thought, oh, I didn't think that that was the thing you were allowed to say. Or I presumed if you didn't mention it, you would protect them from that particular thought. But I know the team at the Zero Suicide Alliance, who more than half a million people have done that training, are really big on that. And again, that's free training that anyone can do. Because I guess as well, it feeds into that wider thing, doesn't it, about if we change the way we talk about mental health, when we cut back when it comes to the stigma, and we change language around mental health, it actually, I think, gives people more opportunity to talk about mental health, as opposed to the opposite of thinking, oh, you can't even call anyone mental anymore, or you can't call somebody a lunatic. It's like, well, maybe it is time to leave that language behind and find a new way of talking. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's not the PC brigade gone mad, or it's not, you know, the millennials, you know, snowflakes. It's about using the right language in the right time. And I think some people now are starting to move forward on that.
I think that's a really important point that you've said. And on that one, I'd just like to pick up on just one more comment on the suicide, where people refer to it as committed suicide, which is not the correct terminology to be using, as you've probably seen with some training that you've done. So we should be saying died by suicide, or thought about suicide, or took their own life, because committed suggests when it used to be an illegal act. And obviously that kind of puts more punishment and more guilt and more shame on that individual, which we don't want to be putting those feelings on people who already felt the need to try and take their own life, which must have been an incredibly distressing time for them. You don't want to put further stigma on them by making it committed and making it sound bad. We want to support them so that people feel they can talk about it and they're not led down a path of feeling that's the only way for them. So the terminology is really important, which is again something that I discuss in my PhD research. And also just making sure that you're kind, because the theme of Mental Health Awareness Week this week is kindness. So if you don't have anything kind to say, or you don't know how to say something, have a look and do a bit of research, because you're not responsible for what other people put online, but you are responsible for what you put online and what you expose yourself to. So I think that it's really important to make sure you're doing your bit to put the correct terms out there, and, you know, teaching your children the correct way to talk about it.
Yeah, I think I think there almost needs to be like a filter on social media that just, I think some posts do this, where as you click send, it should just come up and go, just reread what you're about to post before you post it, because, you know, we've put it through an algorithm and it doesn't look like you're a very nice person. So just double check that. And I think if we all had that thing where, oh, it's social media, I just put it out there, that's what people do, that it's a snipey, snarky place to be. I mean, I'm more than happy to walk away from that particular world if that's what it's going to become, because it's not a nice place to be. And you don't need that sort of aggro in your life, and you certainly don't deserve it.
Yeah, one person can start that chain. And even though you feel like, oh, it's not going to do much me sharing it, if one more person shares it and one more person shares it, you've just got to think about taking that down a level and doing your bit. It's kind of like with COVID, with social distancing. If you can distance yourself from one person who has the illness, you're reducing the R value. I'm not going to go into that. But if you can reduce sharing fake news and sharing bad mental health stigma, again, you're just reducing that a little bit. And the more you reduce it, the more other people think, oh, she seems like a good person that like doesn't share rubbish and shares things that are genuinely helpful and add meaning to people's life. Maybe I should do that a little bit more. And us all just taking that little bit of initiative will just help one more person. That's what I feel anyway.
Sam, you mentioned before people contact you via Instagram. You had those that sort of resource pack that you were looking to send out to people. Just tell people again what's involved in it and how they can make contact with you.
So we have a couple of those. We have a few guides that I've worked on independently. So one of those is called Honest, Healthy, Happy. Forgot the name of my own ebook then. So it's about living a more honest, healthy and happy life. And the healthy version is obviously mentally and physically as well. Everyone can send me a message at MentallyFitSam on Instagram if they want to get hold of that. Or my Twitter is Sam W Psychology, but that's purely for my academic work. Also, some guides that I developed with my friend who's a nutritionist at Apollo Nutrition, and they are on sleep. There's also one on journaling, and there's another one on stress. So there's three of those, and it just talks about how you can make sure that you're educating yourself on it, helping other people. And you can feel free to get these guides and then send them on to other people as well. They're absolutely fine. They're free. A couple of pages gives you the psychological background on each one of those things, a little bit about how you can do it, and then some personal tips on how you can find the best method for you in any of those situations as well.
Brilliant stuff. Instagram, a good place to start, at MentallyFitSam. Sam Orton, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you joining us for this week's edition of Mental Health Monday. And I'm sure we will catch up again very soon.
Thank you. Have a great week, everyone.
There you go. That's Sam at MentallyFitSam on Instagram. We'll get links up on our social media as well. Don't forget, if you want to find mental health services close to you, you can do so using the Hub of Hope, hubofhope.co.uk. Type in your postcode and that will find the services closest to you. A whole host of different national resources on there as well.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle
on Radio City Talk.